Committee, I'm sorry.
Matt, are you okay?
Get out this morning.
Okay. Open up the House Committee on Human Services on today, February 28th, 2011. And I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3037. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, House Bill 3037 provides for an expansion of services through Oregon Project Independence, including in-home and community-based home care supportive services, health promotion services, information on immediate and long-range options, counseling, and transportation service options.
Great. And we have several people signed up to speak. Rodney Schroeder, Mark Lawton?
Pangle.
Thank you. Rick Bennett and Megan Moyer. And we have three chairs up here. If Megan can stop me at the end, okay? Cool.
Madam Chair, do we have a revenue, a fiscal on this?
Go ahead. We have not received the fiscal on it yet.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead. And the other two people I called? Well, I called three people, Rodney, Mark, Rick, and Megan. Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Rodney Schroeder from Salem, Oregon. I work for Northwest Senior and Disability Services. That's the local area agency on aging that serves seniors and people with disabilities in Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. We are members of the O4AD, which is the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging, and I'm testifying on behalf of O4AD today in support of House Bill 3037 with the forthcoming amendments that we're aware are coming. There's been some talking points that have turned in and you should have in your packets, but some of the highlights in those talking points, by the year 2020, it's expected that one in five Oregonians will be age 60 and older. And the fastest growing segment of that aging population is the age 85 and older. And those are the most vulnerable older adults who will tend to need long-term care. And those numbers are expected to double the 85-plus population by the year 2020. U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Administration on Aging have a national strategy to focus on practices that'll promote community-based long-term care services instead of institutionalization or nursing facilities. Some of those practices will include person-centered access to information, evidence-based disease prevention and health promotion, and enhanced nursing home diversion services. Northwest Senior Disability Services is one of the pilot areas in Oregon that is piloting the Aging and Disabilities Resource Centers, and that's with some federal dollars that is to help pilot those in the state. Those are many of the services within that Aging and Disability Resource Center are indeed those three areas I just mentioned, where increased access to information, evidence-based disease prevention, and nursing home diversion. And we are finding very, very good outcomes, very positive outcomes, and a very good benefit in the services that we're offering. But again, I mentioned that's a pilot, and without sustained and ongoing funds, the pilot that we're doing, when those federal grant dollars end, our ability to continue to do that enhanced services will be very difficult, and then the ability to expand those services across the state beyond the pilot sites without increased funding or additional funding from the legislature will be very, very difficult. House Bill 3037 provides that mechanism and that tool to expand and increase those types of activities that keep people out of the nursing facility and allow for the home and community-based care and in the communities where they thrive. It's better and much more cost-effective. We, Northwest Senior Disability Services and the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging, support the concepts that are within the talking points of House Bill 3037. OPI is and has been a proven cost-saving mechanism for the state, and House Bill 3037 offers an opportunity to continue to build on that success. I thank you for your time this morning and my opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions for this? Okay. I see Representative Cowan is here. Would you like to come up right now to testify, Representative?
He was
just to, we got surprised by the move on the agenda, and we're looking for Representative Meyer.
Okay, do you want me to wait?
If you want to go
She's
through
here.
People's testimony,
she just
we'll
can't see her.
Out.
She's Representative Byers here?
Yeah, sometimes you just can't see her.
You banned. Stand up, Derek.
So bad.
Who invited him? Representative Byers.
Oh, see? Oh, no.
Gentlemen, can I invite you to step down and let Representative Byers and Representative Cowan come to testify? Thank you.
Representative Byers, you owe Representative Gillum.
Okay. I'll have
Welcome,
to find out
ladies.
Why.
Well, I'll be happy to fill you in.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking a little frazzled, and we apologize for the confusion. I had, thought this was a couple of bills down on your agenda.
I am so sorry. We were asked to...
It doesn't
agenda,
matter.
So.
We're here.
Thank you.
And as soon as I discovered that, I rushed down, and obviously so did Representative Breyer.
Right.
And...
Oh, dear, I don't know about mine either.
I think someone's calling me back. Sorry.
So we'll both, if you'll give us 1 second, make sure our phones are turned off in this process.
As well as everybody else.
Taking a deep breath.
Right, yes.
I am.
The co-chair reminded me that to remind you to turn off all your cell phones and to please put them, turn them off, because even if they're on mute, that will affect the sound system.
We don't have.
So go ahead, ladies, whenever you're
Thank you very much. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jean Cowan. I'm the state representative from House District 10 on the Central Coast. And to put a little context on House Bill 3037 that you have here before you today, the whole issue of caring for our rapidly growing senior population in the most cost-effective manner, and particularly to try to address some of the needs of people who are not Medicaid eligible, but people who have planned for the end of their working career and the life after that, but may or may not have adequate funds to do so. We've looked at ways that we can help people make the most responsible choices and find situations that meets their needs most effectively. I personally have been working on this for the entire time that I've been here in the legislature, about 6 years. I was the primary caregiver for 6 of my elderly family members through the end of their lives prior to that. And it ran the gamut in all economic classifications and in medical needs and personal needs. So I got a pretty wide range of look at things. And then when I got here as a new legislator in 2007, the first thing I got to be faced with was one of my local assisted care facilities choosing to no longer serve Medicaid individuals, and on a very short 30 to 60 day timeline, leaving 15 individuals trying to find a new place to live. That wasn't a pretty time, and we began to look even more deeply into what are some of the causative issues, how did the rates that are paid to facilities relate, a whole variety of things. And in the end, what I was left with was that we really do need to do to slow the entry into the Medicaid-eligible system, where there are challenges that we're working right now in the budget, and that there are primarily 5 areas that we could make a real difference in people's lives and help them stretch, if you will, their nest eggs much farther. Those are around the ideas of options counseling, helping people figure out what's out there. I know from my own personal experience that when you first start into this, it's like, I should know some of these things, but who do I call? Where do I go? Where do I get the help I need? Secondly, we need a good system of caregiver supports, those natural support systems. When you're in it 24/7 for long enough, it's not a far stretch to feel that someone might burn out. And there are support systems, respite kinds of opportunities, other things that we can do to help people get through those times. And certainly the in-home care, paid relief kinds of assistance that can be available to individuals can make their lives completely different and make them very able to stay in their own home or in the best kind of setting possible. And those paid services, by the way, are a cross-section from private industry to the publicly funded types of systems that we have. And we've all come to recognize a real need to focus more on evidence-based healthy living, how we can help people avoid and deal with chronic disease and fall management in order to make them better able to stay in their own communities. The whole system is around community-based long-term care, be that in-home, in assisted living facilities, in adult foster care. There's a whole wide range of opportunities. And the fifth piece of that is we realize that when people are trying to stay in their own communities, some sort of transportation is also a key factor. And I'm going to leave speaking to that piece to Representative Beyer. It's the reason that we have teamed up. And what we decided to do was to look at the Oregon Project Independence, the OPI statute, and first of all try to modernize it just a little bit to kind of bring some of the terms current. There's a little bit of anxiety that you may hear today around removing some of the terms like homemaker, housekeeper, chore, escort, home health, personal care service. Those are all valuable, but can probably be dealt with a little more effectively if we broaden it into the categories that I just described to you, which you will find in Section 2, Paragraph 1 and 2. That deals with the sorts of issues that I was just describing. There is no specific fiscal impact to this bill. What we know is that the Oregon Project Independence concept and the services that could be provided need to be expanded. There's a secondary conversation going on in revenue around the senior medical exemption and the fact that it is growing sort of out of control and could use some restrictions put on it. But it's clear that any of those things that have been a benefit to the senior aged population, if we gain some savings in that, in any changes there, they really need to be put back into services for seniors. And it's our intent that this bill supply a policy-based methodology for expanding those services should the revenues become available. There is one final thing that I would like to mention. Over the years, there has been some concern with regard to OPI and how expansive it is and how much it, there being so little in the pot, how many people it can actually serve. It is my belief that it should be asset-based eligibility and that should also include the value in an individual's home, because often many of us think of that as one of our primary assets that we will eventually perhaps change if we don't stay in that particular facility and use that towards our other care needs. So we've built a little more robust asset testing into this bill as well, and it's for those reasons. So at this point, I think I would like to stop and turn it over to Representative Beyer, and I do have a couple of points that I need to close with.
Thank you, Representative Beyer. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gilliam, co-chair and committee. I too have been working on an issue all the time I've been in the legislature, and that's been trying to get funding into special needs transportation, which is a federally mandated program, but it comes without money, which is my favorite kind of federally mandated program. So the bigger transit districts have been absorbing these costs, because as long as they offer a service, they have to offer this service. And it does eat into those. The biggest concern, and it is a concern for them, but the biggest concern is in rural areas and trying to get funding into rural areas to help seniors and people with special needs get transported around to medical, personal, any type of a need that they have to be able to keep them in their home and able to move around. So this has been my my issue that I've been working on, and I can talk about it forever, and I'm not going to bore you with that. Representative Cowan and I decided, since we have been so successful, that we would team up and see if we could get some work done together. And again, she did mention that there has been some work looking at the senior medical deduction, and we think these are two wonderful examples of things we could do, and that would enhance the quality of life for seniors, and plow that money back into those programs. A few concerns that the transit people have about the bill, we were trying to work really close together to get this right, is that it really is a modernization of the OPI. It mentions transportation services in it, but we have some concerns that might limit the dollars that might eventually go into that to people who are on OPI, which is a small portion of those people that have transportation needs. So that is a concern of ours as we move forward, and if this bill goes anywhere, is that this could be limiting and could be kind of a paperwork nightmare for the agencies that are providing these services. So with that in mind, I'm here to answer questions.
Representative, go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jean Cowan, just in follow-up, it's always a challenge to put everybody's best ideas onto a piece of paper and then have someone else write them up and hope that they are just what you intended. So I completely share Representative Byers' concerns that we want to make certain that any verbiage doesn't limit the availability of or the opportunity to assist with public transportation opportunities, and we're still looking to see if there is any verbiage change or sort of analyzing that. There's also a bit of a concern in the very first line in section 1, line 1, that we will have a pending amendment on to, and the goal of that is to clarify that there's not an attempt to change what the Area Agency on Aging are doing right now, that we will clarify that, that we expect their kinds of provision of case management and services and sort of helping to funnel people into the right directions. That's the piece of it that I want to make sure that we keep intact. And so for that reason, we will need to be back again with an amendment or two. And at the same time, it will be an opportunity for James Taves from the Department of Human Services to speak to this effort a little bit, too. He was terribly disappointed that it turned out he's out of town, out of state this week, and we didn't want to compromise your schedule. But he has been talking to the health authority and other groups as we work through some of the changes in our big picture system, in how we make sure that we don't lose a focus on the long community-based long-term care system that has been working so well for so many years here in Oregon, in fact, is an exemplary piece. And his concern also that we need to narrow the flow through the door into the Medicaid-eligible kinds of services and what we might do to be able to stem that flow as the population bubble kind of moves through and many of us become eligible for these kinds of assistance. We want to make sure that we can care for ourselves as long as possible before the state needs to do that for us. And so I hope that you will be able to entertain Mr. Taves when he's available, and we will also bring back at least one, if not more, amendments at that time. With that, I think we're both happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. I know both of you have been working on these issues for years, and it's difficult work. And I really appreciate you coming up with the product, and I know you're wanting to refine it some more, and we'll have other hearings with amendments and with Mr. Taves. So thank you for coming. Okay. Any questions? Oh, I do. attitude of these two witnesses. Representative,
good morning. Thank you. You know, last year my grandmother passed, and she had home services, and I don't know if it was through the state or how my family had that set up, but it was just incredibly meaningful to be able to keep her in her home, until the last possible minute where she had to transfer over to a facility. One of the concerns I have, though, is about the asset testing piece, in particular around home value, and I'm not really seeing a whole lot of that in here. Can you describe that a little more for me?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. Representative Parrish, some of the challenges with services provided through Oregon Project Independence only are that there is some sliding scale, but an individual can qualify fairly easily with some level of resources. And then we find that when care providers go into, in my case, their oceanfront homes with wraparound views, you know there's value in that home. I didn't want to build into any of this anything as complex as the cost recovery methodologies that are involved with Medicare or Medicaid, excuse me. But I do think that it's reasonable to take a look at one's value of one's personal property, the mortgage or whatever is owing on that, and the difference would be considered part of a person's asset base. If one needs to leave their homes, then oftentimes those homes are sold and there's availability of resources for it, or there are reverse mortgages or some of the other ways of equities of making use of that difference that's part of your overall asset base to determine whether or not one qualifies for free services. But I want to remind you that there are also available in our communities private businesses that provide in-home care. And if a person has the resources to be able to purchase that, it's still helpful to have some case management that helps people helps you steer people to the right places. As you said, you're not quite sure what the source of the caregivers were, but you knew that they were very helpful to your family. These are all fine people providing really, really important services. And I guess the bottom line is, in order to make everything go farther, those who can pay something for those services probably should, and keep our private businesses going at the same time. Those who are not able to, we can provide some level of other kinds of service.
Can I just follow up?
I think the concern that I want to express is, as we look at housing as a piece of that asset, certainly given the housing market, you know, there was an article just yesterday talking about retire to Portland because the appreciation is the worst in the country right now. So those values being that, you know, folks are having a hard time even tapping the house for credit, let alone trying to sell it. I'd hate to hinge it on just, you know, have somebody be disqualified out, but because they can't tap whatever's in the house because the market is the way it is right now. That would be my only concern in wanting to make sure people still qualify for a program.
Representative, I think that this is a challenging time in the overall industry. We're trying to build programs that will last for a long time, have lasted for a long time. OPI is a very popular, well-loved program. The challenge is it's only able to serve about 2,000 people statewide right now. So we have many people not able to accomplish or to get those services. It would be difficult to build anything around the situation in the mortgage and marketplace at any given moment in time. That's flexible. It changes. A year or two ago, had this been in place, people would have had far more in terms of an asset to draw from, and I believe that that will change again. But I do think that some mention in as we eventually draw up rules as to how we can sort of roll whatever value there is in the rest of an individual's asset base into determining the difference simply between eligibility for totally free and eligibility for some help finding a connection to some other provider is important.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. guys. Can I ask a very specific question, and then I have a more general one, if I may? I'm interested in this Section 4 of the bill, which has to do with eligible people who are less than 19 or older than 19 and disabled. And particularly interested in this thing that rules adopted under this section are only stand for the biennium. I don't remember hearing anything about that before. But would this continue to include disabled adults under 65?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, that's a good question that I would have to read a little more carefully. I know that much of the work that I've done with this is the goal around recognizing as people age out of the disability system and really are more appropriately having the needs of seniors, and there are some glitches in moving through that system, but rather than my taking time to read it carefully, let me get back to you on the intent there.
If I may, with Lamar, yes. Follow up with a more general question. I spent about 25 years of my life working with the national social HMO movement, which allowed people in, I think, six communities around the country, including the Portland area, to buy essentially health insurance for this service as a part of an expanded Medicare model. And I've been looking to seek ways where people could buy insurance for home and community-based long-term care services integrated with medical care insurance for the elderly. And I wonder if there's any way we can move Project Independence, which is a wholly general-funded project, and therefore certainly for the next 10 years is going to be limited by narrowing general funds, to allow folks in the middle-income range, people who are basically served by this, to expand this on a private basis, on a prepaid basis, and whether this is the vehicle to do it, and or whether there are other vehicles. I mean, I think everybody should have access to home and community-based long-term care services when they need it. It's not going to happen with only Medicaid and OPI. We have to find a much broader way. Does this somehow give us a vehicle as we're expanding this to think about ways to make that product more available?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, I'm not familiar with the particular work that you were doing, so it's possible that you and I should sit down and talk about it. Certainly, long-term care insurance is something that the Department of Human Services and others have been encouraging, which would be helpful in terms of keeping people from falling into the Medicaid-eligible services. Personally, as I've looked at the long-term care insurance policies that are out there, I've yet to find anything that I believe meets the real needs of what I'm talking about here.
Absolutely.
Because of the nature of what it takes to actually qualify for benefits from your insurance policy are fairly significant losses of your activities of daily living or ADLs. And it isn't a policy whereby if one decides that now's the time to go and live in an assisted living facility because I really don't want the upkeep on my home and I'd like somebody else to cook my meals and do some of the things that can be available in one of our assisted living facilities, so now I'll tap into my long-term care insurance. It doesn't work that way. So I'm thinking from what I've heard you say that there may be something in between there that you and I could explore more thoroughly. I do think that finding ways for people to think about this farther ahead and take care of as much prepayment towards some sort of level of service, that's part of the education that we need to get to people. You know, we've gone from a time when, I don't know, just don't worry about me. I'm never going to a nursing home. Just take me out and I'm done, you know. Kinds of attitudes to when I take presentations to chambers of commerce or other groups that I talk to all the time about the whole spectrum of the challenge of aging and the importance of community-based long-term care. people listen very intently now with interest, and then it never fails. Someone will come up to me afterwards and say, oh, you know, we're going through this thing with my mother-in-law right now, and what might you share with me? So it's real to people. It's real to us because our elders are still with us, or we have taken them through the process at the end of their lives. And I think there's far more community awareness of what those challenges are out there. So short of providing everything, part of what we're trying to do is education, too, to help people think through what their needs are and how to do it. There's a few pilots working under the model of ADRC, Aging and Disability Resource Centers. The 2009 session, I had a bill that sort of built around that concept, but I spent so much time trying to explain to people what ADRCs were that I decided not to take it down that route. But all of those kinds of efforts that come together to help people know where the resources are, where they can call to find what they are, and hopefully to do pre-planning, I think is the direction we need to go. It might take a separate effort, but we could certainly talk about it.
I'll check in offline. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Any further questions of our two good representatives? Thank you again for all the work that
you're
you've
welcome.
Done, and I know there's more work ahead.
Yeah, thank you.
We have Mark, Rick, Bennett, and Megan.
Thanks.
Thank you. Whoever sits down first can start talking first.
Well, I'll start then. Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, and members of the committee, I'm Mark Pangborn. I happen to be the general manager of the Lane Transit District as well as the president of the Oregon Transit Association, so I'm kind of speaking with both those hats on this morning. I'd like to follow up on what Representative Beyer said. Much of it she'd already covered, and so I won't do that. See if I can kind of lay out the issues. We're talking about having members of our community, the elderly and those who are disabled, continue to live their lives with dignity and independence in the community. Obviously, in the home is the most desirable. It's also the cheapest, probably. But really key to that is their ability to still have mobility. In our society, we function by being able to move out through our community, to get to doctor's appointments, to get to the store, all of those issues. And so this is where public transit comes in for, particularly for the elderly, as they lose the ability to drive. They want to have an option so they can still be independent. And they can do that two ways with public transit. One is they can get on the regular fixed route system, which is the most desirable, actually. And the fixed route transit systems in this state work very hard to do that for both the elderly and the disabled, because that provides them the most access, because the service that the fixed route system goes everywhere in the community or most places, so they have more access there. And we have training programs. We work with one-on-one so they get comfortable. And in Eugene, we have what we call our bus buddy program that's run out of the senior centers. For people who are familiar with the bus, they'll take somebody who has just lost their license, and they'll show them how to use the bus. They'll ride with them and get them comfortable and get the routines in. That doesn't work for everybody. There's people who are frail elderly, they're so disabled that they need this fixed route, the dial-a-ride service that Representative Beyer talked about. This is the unfunded federal mandate, and this is a curb-to-curb service. You call ahead 24 hours, and you arrange a ride. And a vehicle, usually a small, either a car or a wheelchair-equipped van, will come and pick you up and take you to your destination. There is a significant cost difference between the two. For someone riding on the fixed route system in Eugene, it's about $3 a ride. For somebody on a dial-a-ride service, it's $25 a ride. So we have a big interest in getting everybody on, as many people on the fixed route as possible, but people are not able to do that. And the dial-a-ride is the one that really serves particularly the frail elderly and the disabled, and it is the one that we hope we can find a solution with your assistance in terms of funding. To give you an example, in the Lane Transit District in Eugene, because of the recession, this last 2 years, we've had to cut $2.4 million out of the budget. Just we had a less revenue stream because of the unemployment. At the same time, because of demand and because of the fixed route is an ADA-required mandate, we've increased that funding $1.5 million. So while we're cutting fixed route service, it also serves elderly and disabled, we're having to put money into this much more expensive dial-a-ride service. And the same is true in Portland and in the other systems. We're all struggling with this kind. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for assistance in terms of how we can work with that dial-a-ride, because as we get, as was pointed out by Representative Cowan and the previous speaker, is we're all getting older, and we're all entering this group. I as well had a mother that lived with me for many, many years before she passed away, and I used the dial-a-ride service when my family was not able to transfer her around. So it is absolutely critical, but we're going to get into this terrible bind if we can't find a way to create a revenue stream. So we believe that, what is being addressed here in terms of concept is a wonderful idea, and I hope that we can find a way to make it work. So thank you very much, and I'll answer questions.
Thank you. We're going to let all three answer, give testimony, and then we will ask questions.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503, here in Oregon, and we represent the majority of in-home care providers in the Oregon Project Independence Program. These in-home care providers provide a vital service to a significant portion of the 2,000 clients who are in OPI, and we strongly support Representative Cowan and Representative Byers' efforts to modernize this program to make sure that OPI is really having maximum benefit for the population that it's meant to serve. Many of the elements of this bill, I think, are really reflect our changing thinking about how we ought to be looking at the aging population, what services should be available to an individual, particularly before they need higher levels of care. Some of the benefits of OPI have really been maintaining that independence for an individual in their own homes longer than they would have been able to do without this support. I really think one of the things that we often talk about OPI as a cost saver, and for some individuals in OPI it really is when it comes to long-term care costs, but OPI is probably a bigger cost saver to our physical health care system, particularly our federal government and the Medicare program. And I think some of the elements that we're looking at in this bill, in 3037, really look at how do we really maximize somebody's independence, both in their physical health and preventing more expensive long-term care. SEIU does support Representative Cowan's desire to look at some degree of asset testing. I think in these times of very limited resources, we really should be focusing on individuals whom could not, without these resources, maintain their independence or maintain their ability to stay out of our Medicaid system, which is a very cost-effective system here in Oregon, but is not inexpensive. And so we are strongly supportive of option counseling so that individuals can begin their thinking process about their options and how to have their needs met before having to enter into maybe more restrictive than necessary care and more expensive, and therefore causing them to spend down and needing to draw on Medicaid and state resources. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Cowan and Representative Byers on this bill and really see a lot of potential in the direction it's going, and certainly hope that it positions OPI for where we're hoping to get into greater integration or coordination between physical health and long-term care. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. First, let me say that I understand there are amendments coming forth, and not knowing what those amendments are, I hesitate to indicate specific support for the bill. However, I would say that the bill as written and the intent as explained by Representatives Cowan and Byer are very much in keeping with AARP's principles and public policy related to long-term care services and support. I'd also mention, as you know, Oregon does in fact have a model long-term care system with its emphasis on home and community-based services. We are one of a handful of states that in fact has achieved that balance between institutional care and home and community-based services, both in caseload and expenditures, and in fact that has provided tremendous benefit not only to taxpayers but our citizens who would much rather receive support and care in their homes or home-like setting rather than the institutional setting. I think currently our current revenue situation and the impact on our budget has caused a great deal of emphasis on our Medicaid expenditures and how to best coordinate the care, certainly with the long-term care system and with other systems such as acute care and mental health and so forth. And certainly we need to continue to enhance our model system with better coordination. However, we are facing an aging population, and indeed if we do not look at strategies that really have a greater impact on the non- or pre-Medicaid population, no matter what we do as far as the model itself, it's not sustainable. And indeed, House Bill 3037 is, I believe, one of the mechanisms, one of the strategies that indeed looks to provide greater assistance and support to family caregivers. And indeed, a number of surveys, including surveys by AARP, indicate that 94-95% of the caregiving being done in this country and in Oregon is done by family and friends. And there is significant value to that. And so whatever we can do to support and assist family and friends in giving that care, I think in the long run is important to all of us. And certainly House Bill 3037 does that. And for that reason, we certainly support the concept and the idea behind the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Any questions of this panel? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the transportation issues in terms of moving people to fixed route, elderly, poor elderly people, is in fact the fee. And I've tried, at least in terms of TriMet and with some bills like 2315 or something I have now, to try and find significantly reduced fares for people who are, say, eligible for SSI. And I've been having trouble getting TriMet interested in that. I wonder how you do it in Eugene.
At the risk of offending TriMet, and I don't want to do that because they deal
happy
with they have a completely different operating circumstance than we do. I mean, they're 10 times our size, so they different issues. But we've taken a different approach than TriMet. First of all, there are certain regulations that allow people to get a federally mandated disability fare reduction. So we call them half fare. Basically, it's a half fare program, and you qualify. And I don't have the specifics on the top of my head to talk about that, but that would be one. And I think if you are on Social Security disability, then you qualify, not Social Security. We also did something a little different. We have what we call our honored citizens, and we started a number of years ago, and it started with anybody who was 80 or older could come in and get a photo ID and ride on our system for free. And the idea was is we saw 80 as probably, for people who had the ability to drive, that's kind of the point where you probably don't want them on the road anymore, and we want to encourage them. We've actually reduced that age down now to 65 through the years, because what we realize, if people drive all the way up until they lose their license, they're at an age where it's very scary and not very attractive to try to get on the bus system. And we want to encourage people earlier to get on the bus system when they were still more active, still more comfortable about being out in the community and not necessarily intimidated by all of the change in terms of how they get around. So what we've done is, it's not a means test. If you're 65, you can come in and get a bus pass that allows you to ride free on the system at any time. What we found is that
elderly don't want to go on the bus when it's crowded. That is the peak times, which is our worst problem. You know, if, at peak times, if the bus is full, then we have to add another bus if you put extra passengers on it. But they'll go at off-peak times, so they might start riding at 9 and ride from 9 to 3 in the afternoon or maybe in the evening to some kind of entertainment. So it, for us, it's worked in terms of getting elderly on the bus and having it work. I don't know how it would work for TriMet.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In general terms, can you just say a bit about how you see this going? We're expanding, under this bill, we're expanding, but we're also looking at a different, because I think the bill affects the entire OPI program, we're looking at a different way of evaluating who gets in based on whether it's home assets or other assets. We've got 2,000 people, roughly. Do you see this as significantly expanding that number? Or are we just going to shift to a different population? Or do we have any way of knowing at this point in the preliminary part of considering this bill? That is a good one for you, Rick. I was looking at you.
Yes, I was hoping there was somebody behind me. But again, for the record, Rick Bennett, AARP, Oregon. And you know, I'm not sure if expanding is quite the right word to begin with. Certainly, we're redefining services that would be available through OPI. And some of those services really would be more about assisting individuals in accessing services in the private sector that they would pay for with their own resources and so forth. And indeed, no matter what you do with this bill, there really is still a need for additional funding for OPI. There's no question about that. But certainly when you look at some of the clarifications related to assets and so forth, I think that's a mechanism for trying to stretch those dollars as far as possible, understanding that we are very limited in what we can provide in funding for the program.
Follow up if I can. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's getting at it, and I'm not asking you all to answer all these questions, and I'm really glad we're looking at this bill, but we are in a tough spot. Representative Cowan was very articulate about facing this in the face of all of our financial woes. I'm just the first part of the bill says expand. I mean, that's our first under the summary. It says expand services, which I would agree needs to be done, but I am concerned, much as Representative Parrish mentioned, it's an easy thing to target house assets, but it's a very tough thing to come up with a real new fair formula for who's eligible. So I'm looking forward to more discussions on this. I have a great deal of respect for Representative Cowan's expertise in this area, as well as Representative Beyer. She's kind of the transportation czar anyway, so it's not coincidental she's involved in the transportation part of this bill. And it sort of mitigates the other names that might be on the bill as well. So it's going to be tough. We had a good discussion, an OPI discussion last week. I can't even remember what bill it was on, Madam Chair. But my colleague and I agree down here at the end, Representative Greenlick, about the theory about the importance of this program. We probably have, I don't know if it's differences, but we have different perspective on how in the world to pay for it. So those are just thoughts.
Madam Chair, follow up if I could. And the reality is that OPI was really the beginning of what we refer to as the Oregon model. But it is indeed just one piece of a comprehensive system. And each piece of that system much has to be maintained, or basically the whole thing starts to crumble and we wind up with people gradually moving to higher cost settings of care and so forth. Now, Representative Cowan mentioned the senior medical deduction, and I have participated in discussions with the Revenue Committee in past sessions, and I assume I will do so again. And without getting into the specifics of the deduction, there is a legitimate policy discussion to be had there, whether in fact the dollars that are associated with that, and for this next biennium, it's estimated to be approximately $150 million. The policy discussion is whether, in fact, is there greater benefit of using those dollars for a deduction as opposed to direct services. And certainly AARP is willing to participate in that discussion this session or whenever it occurs.
Thanks.
Thank you all very much for coming to testify. And with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3037. Thank you all for coming and sharing information with us. We're going to open up House Bill 2107. Is it just Megan who was signed up? Is there anyone else who was wanting to speak on 2107 besides Megan? I see she's pointing to somebody. Sure. Go ahead. Both of you come on up. I'm opening up the hearing on House Bill 2107. We have a lot of people here to testify on the last bill. Thank you very much. So we're going to speed through. It's good to see you, Megan.
Hi, and thank you. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify in opposition to House Bill 2107. My name is Megan Cahay. I'm the president of Mental Health America of Oregon, which is an advocacy organization for persons with mental health issues. With this bill, as an advocate and as a person who has personal experience of very serious and persistent mental health issues, I am very concerned that this could have unintended effects of discouraging persons with mental health issues from making psychiatric advance directives, known as the Declaration of Mental Health Treatment in Oregon. I do not see this as simply closing a loophole in existing bill. I see it more as focused on basic rights. And I just want to say that having a declaration for mental health treatment is a responsible thing to do. And I think we want to encourage people to make responsible actions to help them deal with the worst times that might happen to them. So I just want to say I ask you to please think about this. Know that this is not simply someone saying, I don't want to take medication, no medication. Many people in their advanced directives will say, this is what works for me, this is what I'm able to find is helpful. And they might say, with other drugs, I've had some very severe side effects with these drugs, and these are what the side effects are, so I don't want to take those drugs because they're not helpful to me. This is a way of giving the providers more information than they might have otherwise, and also enlisting the motivation of the patient who finds themselves in the state hospital. We want them to be motivated to work with providers as a team, not as adversaries. So those are my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan, for coming. Mr. Roberts, it's good to see you.
Good morning. Thank you. Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam and committee members, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent at Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here for the second time. Actually, we were here earlier in February to speak about House Bill 2107, which we are seeking to. Some people have referred to it as closing a loophole. I suppose that's correct terminology, but the point of the change is to have one set of procedures and rules based on one statute for both the civilly committed patients at the hospital as well as the forensically committed patients. In the current statute, the psychiatric advance directives procedures only apply to the civilly committed patients. It's silent regarding forensic patients. So in proposing the bill, we're seeking to have, as I said, simply one set of procedures for both populations. So the issue right now for us would be if a person is brought to the hospital as guilty except for insanity or under a 370 procedure for aid and assist in their defense, if that person has an advance directive, there are no guidelines for how to proceed under that advance directive as there would be if the person were civilly committed. So we just wanted to reiterate that point.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Any questions of either of these? And I think one of the reasons we had another hearing was I think there were people here who had wanted to testify, and I'm sorry that they haven't appeared today. Both of you testified at the earlier hearing. So if you know of anyone who had wanted to testify but wasn't able to come back today, if they could give us written testimony, we'll make sure that it gets to all the members. So thank you very much.
May I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry. Greg, if you would, I just want to verify that all this does, I'm trying to read it here, is allow the same exemption for people who have been found guilty but insane, whatever the charge is, that there would be for a person who is civilly committed?
That's correct.
Thank you for that clarification. Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2107 and open up the House hearing on House Bill 2600. So, Representative Gelsher, good to see you again. Yes, Jennifer, thank you.
House Bill 2600 codifies the Staley Agreement, pertaining to the updating of terminology, creation of definitions, and eligibility of developmental disability services to adults.
Thank you. Could you give us just a brief summary of the Staley Agreement? I think some of us may have forgotten it, and some of us may not have known about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's nice to meet you all for the first time. My name is Sarah Gelser. I represent House District 16 in Corvallis, and for the record, I did ask to be part of this committee. So I come and visit you often. House Bill 2600, there are other people that are going to come after me that are going to better describe this Staley Agreement, but I can give it to you in a thumbnail sketch.
Great.
Oregon, it leads the nation. One of the things that we can be very proud of is we do not have a single adult with a developmental disability living in an institution in the state of Oregon. We are the only state that is closed all of our institutions, and we do not pay to put people in institutions in other states. This is a very exciting thing, and other states are trying to figure out how to be more like us. Part of what went into that was the development of a support services program for adults to help individuals in a more affordable way live in the community. The Staley Settlement put together a brokerage system of supports which allows individuals with developmental disabilities to make their own choices about what is important to help them continue living at home in their family homes. These are individuals that are not living in foster care or group homes, and they can choose through a brokerage which services are best going to support them to live independently. These are very complex organizations. I had the opportunity to speak at the Chicago Community Trust last fall representing the National Council on Disability, and one of the questions that was most asked of me there was, please explain how Oregon has put together this support services brokerage. What House Bill 2600 seeks to do is simply put into statute what is current practice in the state of Oregon through our brokerage system and the Staley Settlement. It also puts into statute important changes in language, moving from mental retardation to intellectual disability. As I stated before, this is a system we can be very proud of in Oregon, although there is still a wait for individuals to receive the services. Like many important programs that we run, there is certainly more that we can do to make it more accessible to more people and to run more smoothly, but this is something that is working very well for clients and demonstrates great partnerships among stakeholders and communities. And as I mentioned before, this is a nationally recognized and admired system and one that people are trying to replicate in other places. It is for that reason that this bill is brought forward. it's not reflected in statute. It is reflected in the settlement agreement. And just as through the closure of our institutions, we determined that these populations of people, adults with intellectual disabilities, should not be invisible in our communities, they also should not be invisible in our statutes. Our statutes should reflect the service system that we have. You're going to hear from a number of people. I am working closely with both the advocates, the brokerage system, and the Department of Human Services. We will have an amendment that we will bring forward at the work session that will hopefully make this kind of budget neutral. As I said, this is not creating a new program. It is putting into statute something that exists. We're working very closely with the department to make sure that that happens. It also puts into statute, and this is very important, the principles of self-determination that are so critical to our system here in Oregon and what makes it so unique. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but the people that come after me are much smarter. They know the system better, and many of them were involved in the development of this really unique system.
Shall we take her to word and not ask her any questions?
All right. Go for it.
Thank you.
We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people who are wanting to testify. We have an hour, so I'm just going to alert you to that, so take that into consideration as you testify.
We're going to hear from Marcy, and I'm going to even begin to work on that one. Margaret Thesia? Thank you. And Kimberly Selman. That one I can pronounce. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Representative Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and the members of the committee. My name is Marcy Engledew, and I am the Executive Director for the ARC of Oregon. My role here today on this panel is to provide a little bit more history than Representative Gelster provided for you today, and to talk about the Staley settlement and not knowing exactly what level of information you already have. I'm going to try to, in a very succinct amount of time, provide a brief overview. I have handouts that I've provided for you today, and what I want to really talk about is the history. So almost 60 years ago, the ARC became the voice for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families. With no services, absolutely none, or choices in places for families, many parents were faced with the idea of turning their child over to the state and giving them to the state institution, at the time sadly called the State Institution for the Feeble-Minded. Fairview was established in 1908, and over time, many, many residents lived there. 2,700 lived in the institution, at sometimes over 3,000. With the help of the ARC, families began to network and raise funds to provide education and supports for their children. Church basements facilitated classrooms with teachers and assistants. Advocacy at the legislature began to address the idea of service delivery system and the opportunity for education for our children. Finally, although many families began to choose to keep their children at home, Fairview continued to grow. Unfortunately, funding, as usual, did not keep up with the growth. The institution became badly overcrowded and understaffed, and as a result, advocates, professionals, and even the federal government advocated and required changes. Throughout the 70s and 80s, changes were forced at Fairview, and finally the population began to shrink. Which brings us to the 90s, when we truly began to maybe see the end of the light at the tunnel for the closure of a state institution in Oregon. Not only was it the right thing to do for individuals within to live in the community, it was also extremely cost-effective for the state of Oregon. Unfortunately, at the same time, families were forced to provide the services and supports in their homes for their loved ones. There was very limited access to comprehensive services, and a wait list continued to grow. Unfortunately, when your child was very young, as a parent, you were told, get your child on a wait list if you wanted any services when they became an adult. In the late 1990s, the ARC and a number of advocacy organizations organized to address the wait list crisis. And in January 2000, 5 individuals with intellectual disabilities and their families, along with the ARC of Oregon, filed a lawsuit against Governor Kitzhaber and the state of Oregon. The Staley versus Kitzhaber became a class action representing over 3,000 Oregonians with developmental disabilities. A settlement was reached in September 2000, and the Oregon legislature made available $37 million general fund dollars for the first biennium of funding. Implementation of the Staley versus Kitsap Harbor settlement began on July 1, 2001. To complement the comprehensive service systems where services cost over $20,000 per year, the self-directed support system under the Staley settlement began the planning the process to develop a system using the Medicaid home and community-based waiver along with general fund dollars. The Staley implementation group was formed to provide input and guidance to the Department of Human Services through this process. Using a regional model and contracting nonprofit organizations, the SIG developed a system of brokerages around the state that are now contracted by the Department of Human Services. County developmental disability programs refer clients to the brokerages set up regionally around the state, and based at that time on a determined priority schedule, brokerages began assisting individuals with developmental disabilities to build a life for themselves in the community. A number of examples in my testimony include that services that are brokered include personal care, help getting a job, job coaching, support staff in the home and in the community, behavior consultation, respite care, special equipment, and transportation. In 2003, due to extreme budget difficulties, the Staley settlement was modified to extend the settlement from 2007 to 2011. Although this slowed down the enrollment into the brokerage, it did not change the benefit levels or the intent of the system. By June 30, 2009, the Staley agreement allowed that all individuals eligible for services would receive the opportunity for self-directed support services within 90 days of acceptance of service. This past fall, the 13th brokerage opened its doors to provide capacity for those individuals entitled to receive self-directed support services. Today, over 8,000 individuals are enrolled and receiving services. As Representative Gelser talked about, Oregon is a leader throughout the nation in the field of self-directed support services. We have continued to address the needs and support for our most vulnerable citizens, while addressing the continued reductions in the cost of services for over a century. Based on this history, we reiterate our support of House Bill 2600. This bill puts the critical components of this service into statute. In addition, I've given you a very brief history and have attached to my testimony some additional information that we've continued to gather over time that's available to the public and there for you if you want to get more involved into the history of that. Other than that, my role today was the history, and if you have any questions, I'd be certainly happy to answer them.
Any quick questions? Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Margaret Tyson, the Chief Executive Officer with Full Access, one of the 13 support services brokerages. I'm also the President of the Oregon Support Services Association, and thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 2600. When the Staley settlement occurred nearly 10 years ago, this did birth a unique and cost-effective approach to social services system for people with developmental and or intellectual disabilities. As such, we led the movement in the nation to a design that values the innate power, rights, and responsibilities of these citizens and draws upon their own, their family, and community resources as the fulcrum of the services delivered. The legal standing of the settlement has been critical to shaping the system, and now it is time to continue this through the legislative process and passage of House Bill 2600, ensuring rightful representation of people with developmental and or intellectual disabilities. It is important to acknowledge the context of this transition in that Oregon is the only state in the nation that does not either institutionalize these citizens or send them to other states that have institutions. The history of institutionalization is abhorrent. A noteworthy validation of this was the formal public apology in December of 2002 rendered by Governor Kitzhaber regarding the treatment of individuals at Oregon's institution, the Fairview Training Center. specifically the practice of forced sterilization of Fairview residents. One of the women victimized by this practice is currently receiving services in our brokerage. We have come a long way. There is a long way to go. The individual customers in support services brokerages are people who experience disabilities on an extensive continuum, and identifying a typical person cannot occur. We do know that the people currently getting support services have more complex and frequently occurring disabilities than is historically true. Developmental disability is a term used to describe lifelong disabilities attributable to mental and or physical issues manifested prior to age 18. This includes people with cerebral palsy, autism spectrum disorders, various genetic and chromosomal disorders such as Down syndrome and Fragile X syndrome, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. The system we operate is complex for an array of reasons, from the complex lives our customers live to the systemic requirements related to funding and verification of compliance with multiple government entities. In brief, the role of the support services is to provide case coordination and brokering of the most cost-effective services, ensuring customer control and direction in the planning and delivery of their support. Case coordination includes, but is not limited to, identifying the support that naturally occurs with the individual, expanding those no-cost supports, and assessing the individual's disability-related needs that are not addressed and require state funding to ensure basic health and safety of that person. Secondly, when the customer's plans have been established, the brokerage connects the individuals to community resources that are no-cost, low-cost, or require a formal agreement and payment between them and a provider of support, such as a community agency or someone directly employed by them. Approximately 90% of participants in support services brokerages are Medicaid eligible. Therefore, federal matching funds are utilized with state general fund dollars. We do value and appreciate the privilege of supporting our customers and their families and the opportunity to continue this effort with you. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 2600 and our testimony for passage of this bill.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kim Selman, Assistant Director for Full Access from the Central Oregon region. I would like to share with you a testimony from one of the individuals we serve. My name is Katie. I'm 26 years old, and I was born with cerebral palsy. When I enrolled in the brokerage in 2004, I was living with my dad. I moved a couple of times after that, but I always lived with someone else. My ultimate goal was to live independently and to be able to access and be integrated into my community just like anyone else. I utilize a power wheelchair for mobility, which I can operate independently, but I am dependent upon someone else for all aspects of my daily living. Due to the natural supports and the paid supports I received from the brokerage, my ultimate goal of being able to live in my own apartment was achieved in September of last year. I have a provider come to my apartment in the morning. She helps me out of bed, bathes me, dresses me, helps me with my hair and my makeup. She makes me my breakfast, she feeds me, and helps me clean my apartment and pay my bills. She then makes me my lunch and feeds me. She helps me with my laundry, making my grocery list, and takes me grocery shopping and run other necessary errands. My apartment is accessible, so then I have free rein to my community. I live downtown, so I love to go shopping and visit with the many natural supports that I have built in my community. In the evening, I have someone else come and make my dinner, feed me, administer my medications. She brushes my teeth, she helps me into my pajamas, and eventually lay me into my bed. Having this level of independence is of the utmost importance to me.
despite how comprehensive my supports are, because they're both paid and unpaid, they only cost $14,311 a year. Without the supports I receive with my support service dollars, I would be forced to live in a facility, a group home, or foster home. Not only would this restrict my independence and remove me from my home, but the cost of my supports would increase dramatically. On behalf of Katie and more than 7,000 Oregonians with developmental disabilities, we thank you for your consideration and passage of House Bill 2600.
Thank you, Ms. Selman. Any questions of any of these nice folks that came before us? Thank you so much for testifying today. And thanks for all the work you do.
You're welcome.
And Bergren, is that at least close? Jennifer Beckett and Mike Malley.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anna Bergren. I work at Full Access as a lead personal agent. I've been an agent for 5 years and focus both on client services as well as community development activities. In the past, when people with developmental disabilities were in institutions such as Fairview, not only was the treatment inhumane, the financial costs were extreme. As our customer, Katie, has written, that Kimberly read for you, the value of her life and community involvement is measured primarily in her personal successes and independence, but she also recognizes the value of the cost of her support. As she noted, support services through brokerages are life-changing and are more affordable than other alternatives. Statewide, our developmental disability services creates environments that respects individuals' rights and responsibilities both. Having worked with people to ensure their health and safety, as well as encourage their growth and independence, I can attest to the incredibly difficult work they put forward to make their lives work. As their partners in this pursuit, we value the state's interest in vulnerable citizens and request the passage of House Bill 2600. And thank you for your consideration.
Co-Chair Tomei and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Bickett. I'm the executive director of a brokerage up in the Portland metro area, Community Pathways. And I wanted to speak to you just a little bit today about kind of what those services look like in a brokerage and what we call personal agents who are case managers kind of do in the day-to-day role in helping people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. And the three kind of main primary roles of that are to meet with families and the customer themselves and to kind of plan for their services, to get those services, and then to monitor those services. And in planning for those services, one of the first things they do is look at kind of what is already exists in the person's life and what those resources are. So we look at, like, all the natural resources and then kind of look to see what may be needed as it relates to someone's disability. So maybe someone just maybe the family needs a little bit of respite to kind of give them a break from time to time, or maybe the person needs some support to go out and find a job. And so the personal agent will look at that. They'll, you know, look at a number of free resources in the community, as well as if paid supports are needed, what those paid supports might be. In getting those services, they look at only those services as they relate to the person's disability. So while a personal agent might look with a person what their dreams might be, like living independently in a home, the services that they would actually get to do that would be the services that were needed to teach them how to, say, cook a meal, or maybe they just need somebody to come in and help prepare meals once or twice a week so that then they can reheat those meals or have that on their own. So I guess I want to stress that the services that are paid for are really only those services that are needed. And then another big piece of that job is to monitor those services. So at least monthly, the personal agents will look at invoices and see what services the person's providing and how the effectiveness of those services. And then we amend and change plans as needed. This is kind of a simple overview of what the brokerage does. more complex. I'd say, you know, there are 7,000 people being served by brokerages in the state of Oregon, and it's like running 7,000 individual businesses. The level of knowledge that is needed by those personal agents is great. So not only the Oregon administrative rules, but also, you know, BOLI and IRS laws, you know, because additionally we help to fund those providers, or we are the pass-through for those providers. So making sure that we're following all those regulations and helping customers to be their own businesses. We also have a great opportunity to work with a number of community partners. I sit on a task force up in Portland that works with the Portland Police Department in helping to make sure that people in the community with disabilities are represented and the police know how to work with those people, as well as working with people to go to doctor's appointments in hospitals and to prevent more expensive care by being able to keep them in their home. And I guess I just want to stress also that this is a foundation to help keep people out of more expensive group homes and foster care homes. We work with a number of people who, without our support, would, you know, need to look at those more costly expenses. And our supports, the average person has about $14,000 in their plan, but not everybody uses that full amount. I'd say most people use well under that because the funding is there just for those disability-related supports. So if people don't need as much support, then they aren't receiving that. And I don't know if the state will probably testify to this too, that the average cost for the brokerage, both the services that a person gets and then the actual cost for the brokerage, is around $12,000 a year. When somebody goes into a comprehensive service, that jumps to more like $45,000 or $50,000 a year. So the services that people are getting are very effective. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Any questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For any of you, these services sounds like you're doing a great job, right? How do you imagine this bill will change what you're doing?
Representative Greenlick, I believe that what this bill would do is to set into statute and solidify the services that we are doing and make it, you know, known to others as well that this is a very valuable service in the state of Oregon.
If I may just briefly, fellow?
Yes.
You sense that I understand the symbolic nature, and I think symbols are very important, but you sense that the current situation is at risk because of financial problems of others?
Well, I guess to answer that, having worked in the brokerage system under the Staley agreement, I've always felt that it was protected because we were under that agreement. And as that ends in 2011, I feel very strongly that this bill would help solidify these services, which are very not only innovative but extremely cost effective and very humane in supporting people. And to answer that as well, I think that it's a great venue for other types of supports that when vulnerable people need additional support to be able to support people in their communities.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Mike Maley. I'm a program manager for community services in the Office of Developmental Disability Services within seniors and people with disabilities within the Department of Human Services. And I provided a written testimony. I think it's just one page front and back. And many of the things that I've written have already been testified to, so I won't kind of go over those. I'll just do the Reader's Digest version of that. But there's a couple of points that I do want to make. Number one is that I'm here to certainly attest to the significance of the adult support services in our service system. They are, in fact, a cornerstone and have significance not only in terms of our recent history, like you've heard, and kind of our immediate future, but has been, I think, alluded to, these services are critically important as we look for maintaining a sustainable service system over the next several years, because they are in fact a principal vehicle to either prevent or delay access to services to more costly types of care in our system. So it is important that they maintain within our service system as we've got it arranged today. As Representative Gelser commented in her introductory testimony, there were some areas in the bill as originally submitted that we believe would have a fiscal impact. And on the back part, on the second page of the testimony that I provided, I enumerated those. But also, as she testified, that we've been working on amendments together to deal with those issues. And should those amendments come forward, as we've all been discussing them, then the department would certainly be in support of the bill with those amendments that we believe are forthcoming.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, what will happen if we don't pass this bill?
Right now, the services are contained in the governor's balanced budget proposal to you all. And we would continue to provide the services, I think, within the framework that you've seen in this bill. So they would continue, assuming that everything is included in the governor's budget.
So, Mike, help me understand. So if we don't have, this is in the governor's budget, which
yes.
is not necessarily the legislature's
that's correct.
Budget.
That, as proposed.
So if, say, there's a new governor in 4 years and we don't have this in statute, then what might happen?
Well, I'm speculating here.
Right,
I think where I would start in commenting is going back to what I initially said before. These are critically important services. They are entrenched in our service system. We have over 7,600 people, in service. They've proven to be cost effective. The satisfaction with the services are extremely high. So we believe that on their merit, they will, in fact, continue. I think the significance of, and again, I can't always speak to the intent of the people who submitted the legislation, but I think an advantage of this legislation is it is very specific in terms of the framework in which the services are to be delivered. The notion of the
getting
self,
at, Mike,
the notion of the self-determination. I'm sorry.
I guess what I'm getting at is now it's required under the Staley Agreement until this coming summer, correct?
Correct, till June 30th.
So once the Staley Agreement is over, then the state is not obliged to follow through with these services that are now provided.
Yeah, in theory, other than the fact that we're serving so many people, in a cost-effective system that people really like. But again, I think Chair Tomei, if I can, in terms of following up on that question, on one hand, we can say we'll continue adult support services. I think with this particular bill, it does in fact get pretty specific in terms of the framework, because in terms of the stakeholder involvement of the oversight, in terms of the philosophy, in terms of the intent of the services themselves. So it's much more than just saying a certain type of program will continue. There's a richness to it. And I think, as you've heard already, and as you will, I'm sure, hear from people that are going to testify after this panel, it's some of those fundamental kind of philosophical structural principles that are key to the ongoing success that the program's had so far.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I can add to what you said.
Yes.
These services, the reason I asked the question, I sense where you're going as well, sitting on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Human Services, these services are being challenged on other components of this population. I think it really, this is really not a trivial issue in terms of trying to maintain services for this subpopulation, because other elements of the intellectually challenged population are under fire right now. And it's a very
Excellent.
Important issue.
Thank you very much. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we take out the fiscal issues that you identify in your testimony, is it an overstatement to say codifying the Staley Agreement basically is the same thing? In other words, the agreement is contained in this legislation, no more, no less, without the fiscal issues.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, it is fair to say that the principal structure and framework and drivers, you know, that frame the services that were representative in the settlement agreement are represented in this statute.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thank you very much, ladies. I'm going to invite Representative Gelster to come back up. Thank you very much. By the way, we've been joined by occupational therapy students from Pacific University and occupational therapy assistant students from Lynn Benton Community College. Welcome to your state capital. And you are in the Human Services Committee, and we are hearing issues about House Bill 2600, which has to do with services for people with disabilities. And Representative Gelser is the person who wrote this new legislation and is going to tell us more about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Welcome to occupational therapists. I think occupational therapists are great. I thought I could offer a pretty direct answer to your question and to Representative Greenlicks. The importance of passing this legislation is that without it, it just doesn't exist in statute. And when you are a Ways and Means Committee that is looking at where you need to go to eliminate services, or if you are in an allotment cut reduction, it is much more difficult. You become an easy target when you don't have to make a statutory change in order to eliminate those services. And that goes back to the comment that I made before. This is one of the best services that we offer in the state of Oregon, but it currently does not reside in our statute. It is invisible in the statute. The second thing that I would point out is the reason that it is invisible in the statute is that the voices of this population are so small that they were not created by an act of the legislature. They were created by a grassroots movement of individuals with intellectual disabilities and their families that had to sue the state of Oregon in order to get a settlement to have access to these cost-effective, very humane services that respect them as individuals. And that is my fear. Nobody wants to eliminate these services, but it is a very easy target to eliminate, especially when it is not in statute. Let's maintain the status quo. Let's enshrine these critical services into statute and not roll the clock back a decade or two decades and force these fine people to come back and go through a legal process to put back in place a system that they have demonstrated works better than almost any other social service system that we have in terms of accountability, transparency, affordability, and effectiveness.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for being here, Representative Gelser. Question on this, looking at this, you know our fiscal situation, and it sounds like you're going to take care of the fiscal issues, but we're seeing a lot of bills like this come forward at this time, but nobody's coming forward, and as representatives, to me, we need to be looking at what agencies or departments can we get rid of, but where are we going to make the cuts? And when we add more things to what we're going to include, it just drives up the cost more and more. So would you suggest getting rid of the Oregon Health Plan? What would you suggest getting rid of to ensure that we can fund this if we were to put it in statute?
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Widener, I'm really glad you asked that question because it allows me to get at it in a different way. We don't have to eliminate anything else in order to do this. I think with the amendments that we are working with the Department of Human Services, we are talking about maintaining what is the current service system. We are not adding, there is nothing new in this legislation. It is continuing what it is that we have started. If we were not to do this and this program were to be reduced, we would be at risk of increased expenditures by forcing these 7,000 to 8,000 people into nursing homes and foster care. And then we would have to be looking at what other programs would we need to cut in order to pay for these entitled services in a much more expensive and less respectful environment.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
That's what I'm right now. We are needing to make cuts. That's why I'm asking which department, what agency would you look at doing that so we could sustain this? Because this is a very good program. I have it, groups running in my very county that are doing an excellent job with this program. But we have to make cuts. And you've worked in the Department of Human Services. Where are some of the failures that are happening in that department that we can look at for a change in policy to make these cuts so we have money to keep programs like this going?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, there's so many names to get into the introduction now. Thank you again for that question as well. I think that one of the components of continuing these services, if you look at the governor's balanced budget proposal, brokerage services and Staley settlement services take substantial reductions, as do all programs in seniors and people with disabilities. The other thing that you will see in the governor's balanced budget proposal is a raid of the Fairview Housing Trust, taking $7 million out of the sale of the principal of that program in order to buy back some of these developmental disability services. We do not see a direct line that those monies that are sitting in a fund that have been promised to keep individuals with developmental disabilities in the community are being directed only to those programs. So I would argue in the governor's balanced budget and historically over the last 10 to 20 years, seniors and people with disabilities and developmental disability programs in particular have taken more than their proportional share of reductions. And I think that is because it is a group that does not have a particularly powerful voice in the legislature. So in sum, this program, even with this bill, is already taking more than its proportional share of reductions in the governor's balanced budget. There will be less money spent on that next biennium than this biennium if everything continues as in the governor's balanced budget proposal.
Madam Chair, that didn't answer my question. I said this is a great program. I don't want to see cuts here. I want to know in human services where you had worked where we could make those cuts, because you brought in autism, adding that to the Oregon Health Plan, things like that. Where can we make cuts to make sure we keep this funded, because this is a very important program. I don't want to see it have to face cuts.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, Representative Widener, when I worked at the Department of Human Services years ago, I worked in seniors and people with disabilities, and I saw a very under-resourced, understaffed program with tremendously creative people with great values trying to serve a population of people with tremendous waiting lists. I did not work in the rest of the department, so I can't point to those other services. I simply know that in the developmental disability service system, you have great, ethical, honest, creative people working very hard to make a penny stretch as far as it possibly can. And I can't point to a recommended reduction within the developmental disability service system beyond what is already being taken.
We're going to move on. Representative, sounds like you need to take this offline a little bit.
Yeah.
You bet. Representative Gilliam.
One more time on my previous question.
Yes.
You're willing to work with the department on removing the fiscal. That's correct.
That is correct, yes.
I've got a couple here. Is that all right?
Sure.
And so we'll have amendments coming.
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I have in my possession recommended language from the Department of Human Services that has also been reviewed by the advocates. My understanding is everyone is in agreement with those language. Should you give the go-ahead that we should have those amendments prepared for a work session, we will turn that into Legislative Council and be able to review the actual language.
Then my last question, thank you, is recognizing this is not an easy task to codify. I mean, it just isn't. But generally speaking, without the fiscal issues that we've already set aside, no more, no less, this is codifying the Staley Agreement. Is that a fair statement?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, with the amendments, this would be no more, no less codifying the Staley Agreement and the principles that are embedded within it in our state statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. We have Beverly and Megan Moyer. Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak on this piece of legislation? Okay. Go ahead, Megan.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer.
I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503, and I'm here testifying in favor of House Bill 2600 and codifying the SALE agreement into statute. Particularly, SEIU would like to be testifying in favor of putting the values of the SALE settlement into statute, and those values are incredibly important to the foundation of the brokerage system, but also in the foundation of how we look at providing services to people with disabilities. Some of the components that I'd like to point out as particularly important and the role that SALE played in really bringing Oregon forward as we look at services was person-centered planning, which is actually not universally recognized in every state, but Oregon has, through SALE, really focused on making sure that when we provide services to people with disabilities, that they are at the center of that service plan, that it is individualized, it is directed and determined by an individual. No two plans are alike. You cannot categorize an individual and say, you fit in box X, so you will be getting this plan. I did your assessment, you fit in box Y, your plan will look this way. Brokerage services are individualized and done with consumers in a way that meets their needs and their goals. It is also a value of the brokerage system and the SALE agreement to promote self-determination and community inclusion. These are values that SEIU believes are basic human rights and should be in statute and need to be in statute and currently are not in statute. And therefore, we strongly believe, both for the practical reasons discussed prior, but also for symbolic reasons, as Representative Greenlick referenced earlier, that passing 2600 is an important step in Oregon in formalizing our commitment to a service system that is person-centric, that is individualized, and is empowering to the individuals whom are receiving service. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Go ahead.
Representative Tomei, Representative Gillum, honorable members of the House Human Services Committee. My name is Beverly Heron. I'm the Executive Director of Resource Connections of Oregon. We are contracted to serve 745 people in Lynn, Marion, and Yamhill counties. I'm here to provide you with three examples of adults who receive support services from RCO as a way to show you the importance of passing House Bill 2600. As a support service brokerage, we have the privilege of working with many different people who have a wide variety of support needs. It would be difficult to give you a snapshot of a typical customer. Many people we serve have paying jobs, volunteer positions, or other activities in the community that require their regular attendance. They use mass transit or specialized transportation services to get to their jobs and other appointments. Many of our customers have assistance with meal planning and budgeting, making medical appointments, and other typical tasks of day-to-day living. While these tasks may seem mundane and unremarkable, the act of individuals with developmental disabilities directing their lives is still considered remarkable. I've attached comments from two sisters who are both customers of RCO and their mother. Their comments are heartfelt and focus on their appreciation of being able to have a say in how their supports are developed and managed. As a single head of household, their mother must work full-time outside of the house. These young women could be considered typical support service customers based on their individual support plans. They have assistance with active engagement in their communities and medication management. It is when you get beyond the typical supports they each use that you realize that they are unique individuals with distinct goals and needs. One of the sisters is legally blind, and the other has mental health concerns. The one with mental health concerns has an extensive safety plan she has developed for when she hears voices telling her to harm herself. She knows who to call when she starts to hear the voices and what to say based upon a written script. RCO is well aware of the plan, is able to assist with additional supports if needed. Many of our customers are this kind of typical. In the past, their needs for support would have kept them apart from society. With support services, they are now able to be a part of society. For some of our customers, life is very different than this. This past Friday, I was part of a team that has been working with a young woman I will call Alice, who has lived a life far from typical. About 10 years ago, her mother and stepfather divorced. The stepfather was awarded custody of her two half-sisters, but Alice was left to live with her mother. Alice was still in school when this occurred. She would sometimes go to school with matted hair, dirty clothes, and hungry. Her extended family includes an aunt, her stepfather, and two stepsisters. Over the years, the aunt and stepsisters have tried to provide assistance to Alice as her mother's mental health problems and drug involvement took a greater and greater toll on Alice's health and safety. The services RCO has been able to provide included respite at the aunt's house and constant personal agent supports to Alice and her mother. The situation would change from month to month, depending on the mother's ability to hold a job. Alice's stepsisters were as involved as they could be, always depending on RCO and others to act as a buffer between themselves and their estranged mother. As the sisters are now in their mid-20s, they have been able to take on more and more direct responsibilities. 2 months ago, one sister was able to gain control over Alice's SSI payments. The other sister was in a position to take over guardianship, but had no financial resources to petition the court for this. With the assistance of Marion County Indigent Guardianship Services, RCO was able to find an attorney willing to accept the case, and emergency guardianship was granted to the sister this past Friday morning. The sister, RCO staff, and the attorney were able to serve the emergency guardianship papers to the mother and to Alice Friday afternoon. At this time, her sister was able to take physical custody of her. Based upon past history and information provided by an acquaintance of the mother's, Alice was taken to the Salem Hospital emergency room for a drug screening. After the initial toxicology tests were run, our worst suspicions were confirmed, as opiates and tricyclic drugs were found in her system. This required further testing and additional time in the emergency room. All the while, the sister and RCO staff were present to provide support and information to Alice and hospital staff. When she was able to be discharged, we were convinced she would be going to a household that will be safe and loving. RCO will be able to remain her support service brokerage, even though Alice will be living with her sister in a different county than she had been. Her personal agent will be the same one she's used to working with. Her individual support plan will change to reflect her new living situation and any change in support services she may have. The new guardian, who is now in her mid-20s, working, and a student, will have support with systems issues from RCO. Alice's extended family will be able to fulfill the familial obligations they have wanted to provide for the past 20 years, or for the past 10 years, excuse me. Alice's situation may seem extreme. During any given week, it is routine to have at least one situation in our brokerage that is similar to this in its complexity and level of risk to the individual we serve. Some of these situations seem intractable and go on for years until the hard work of personal agents and other advocates finally pays off. On any given day, I have seen the very best and the very worst of how people with disabilities are treated by society. It is the role of the support service brokerage to be the coordinator of services for some of our most vulnerable citizens. For those of us who work in support service brokerages, it means we have jobs where we can focus on the endless capacity of people who too often are thought of as less than. We are allowed to have a part in making sure their lives are a reflection of their goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions of either of these witnesses? Thank you very much for coming today, and thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, do you know the mascot for Pacific University?
I don't.
How many are boxers here today? And then how many are from Lynn Bitten? Now, by a nod of your head...
I have not closed the public hearing yet. I just...
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2600. And now proceed, Mr. Coach. Right.
Now, is Lynn Bitten in your district, Representative Gelzer? Is Lynn Benton, try to pay attention, I'm the co-chair up here. Lynn Benton in your district?
Yes, it is.
So how many are from Lynn Benton? Uh-huh. She takes a crowd wherever she goes.
You're going to tell me the mascot?
Well, I don't know the Lynn Benton mascot. Apparently don't have one. It's the Fighting Gelsers.
It's the Aardvark, Mr. Chair.
It's the Aardvark.
Okay, we have a meeting on Wednesday, colleagues. What, 8 o'clock, right? Our meetings are going to be at 8 o'clock until further notice. And we hope to see you there. Hope it's easier to get there on Wednesday. Yep. With that, I close the House Committee on Human